Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Jay McEntee. He's an assistant professor of biology here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Jay, you're a biologist, but of course there's many different kinds of biologists. So how do you see yourself from a biology point of view?
Well, I'm for the most part, I'm an evolutionary biologist, and so I like to study the kind of mechanisms that contribute to the kind of diversity that we see in nature, different species that exist, different variations within species. So I want to understand how those new kind of forms arise over the course of evolutionary time, how we get new diversity. And for the most part, I study vertebrates, and so I concentrate on studying vertebrate evolution. And within vertebrates, I really like to study birds.
Now, of course, when people think of evolution, they think of, the body type changes and things like that, or even beak changes in finches or whatever it is they're thinking about. But you're interested in something else that also has some sort of evolutionary structure to it, conceivably. And what is that exactly?
So I focus a lot of my energy on studying the evolution of bird song. And in particular, I'm interested in the evolution of bird song in species that learn song. So that's not all species of birds, but it turns out to be over half of the species of birds learn how to sing or have some component of song that is really influenced by their experiences. So they develop their song in accordance with the experiences that they have observing other individuals singing. And so there are these kind of twin processes that might influence the evolution of birdsong, where we have this kind of underlying changes, like on a genetic level, that probably drive some of the differences that we see. And then there's also the potential for this kind of cultural evolution, where there are changes that can arise via the learning process and the outcomes of the learning process.
Let's just talk a little bit about birds. I don't know a tremendous about them, but if you were to think of a crow or something that just has this thing that sounds like a squawk, that doesn't fall into singing, does it? Or is that, in other words, is that learned also? Or would something like a crow just know how to make the particular noises it makes? Or does it still have to learn what it does?
You've picked a really tough example. So crows fall out within the group of birds, the biggest group of birds that all learn their vocalizations.
They do learn that.
So crows, at least we would strongly suspect, have the capacity to learn. And so the array of different sounds that they make is probably influenced heavily by learning. But a crow could probably, if you raised it on its own without hearing any other crows, it's probably going to make a sound that doesn't sound crazy far off from from what other crows might sound like. So they have pretty simplistic short vocalizations, right? Crows and jays are in the same family of birds that the crows are. And those birds, they're within that bigger group of birds that all learn song, but they have really simplistic vocalizations by comparison, the individual kind of utterances that make up their repertoire of different sounds. They're simple. So other birds we have, like house finches. So house finches are a common species that you could find outside your home in Missouri in the spring, and they have much, much longer songs, and they're much more complicated. And so when we think about learning and we think about how much influence learning has on ultimately what a bird sounds like, it probably plays a bigger role in those species that have these more complicated, longer vocalizations than it does in those that have the shorter, squawky sounds.
Right. Now, let's think about this timescale piece of this, because most people think about evolution and they think, well, how can you study that? I mean, we're talking, thousands of years for things to change? But not necessarily, because if birds can learn, then there must be more to it than that. So what does the timescale sort of pattern of this look like?
Right, so it varies. And so there are probably some changes that can accumulate over a really short period of time, say within a generation for birds that learn, because say you have a small number of birds that disperse from some population and they go to somewhere new where there are no other birds there of their species. You can have that kind of circumstance happen, at least theoretically, where if a group of birds goes and disperses to some new area, they can kind of invent a new song culture there because they might not have other birds to learn from. And so they might have to generate new songs by improvising instead of learning from other individuals. So there's at least the potential for there to be pretty substantial changes over a really short amount of time. And in addition to that, there's actually a really good recent example of this kind of sudden change that's happening over a really short period of time. There's a bird called the white-throated sparrow. You can go outside and hear it in Missouri right now, and in your backyard, in any residential area, you'll be able to hear white-throated sparrows. And it's been documented that just over the past 20 or 30 years, there's been a change to their song. And it's sweeping across North America from the west, from about Vancouver Island was where this new song was heard for the first time. And it seems to be sweeping all the way across the country just on a kind of decadal time scale. And so that kind of change can happen in these traits that are learned, because there's the potential for there to be this rapid change through the learning process with no underlying genetic change that's necessary for that kind of new trait to evolve.
So let's think about this then. When you have a song and you have birds have evolutionarily developed in some way, shape, or form the ability to innately sing, but they don't know their songs yet, then if their songs are evolving, but they're still within the side the same species, which parts of their song sort of stay the same and which parts evolve? I mean, if you think about it, there's pitch, there's pace, the short notes and long notes. I mean, if you think about music, you think about all these different things. So do they still stay within a certain set of parameters in one sense, but then change another parameter, like how quickly they do things, or how does that work? There's a lot there.
That's beautifully put. Exactly. That's almost exactly how we kind of conceive of this working. So within a species, for the most part, there's a kind of bounds on what the song is going to sound like. It'll only take on kind of certain durations, so it can only be, you know, so short or so long. It'll be found within bounds on pitch, so it can only be so low pitched and so high pitched. But within that kind of set of parameters, there's a lot of variation that can take place. And especially for these birds that learn song, if you move among populations across space, across geography, you can find a lot of variation among populations. And we refer to that usually as there being dialects of song. Sometimes we refer to that as there being neighborhoods with different songs, where birds are sharing some set of kind of particular unique songs that they'll sing kind of at a population level or at a neighborhood level. And then if you move to a different area, you'll find different songs in that other area.
Interesting. And so the birds that sing, broadly, why are they singing? Are all the birds singing, or is just one gender singing? Why are they singing? And how many different songs would a species perhaps have? I mean, can it vary widely from one species has one song that they constantly repeat and to the detriment of everybody else's hearing to something else that can have thousands of songs, or is it less diverse than that?
Okay, so I'll start with the second part of the question there. So it varies hugely among birds. So among birds that learn song, well, there's a lot more variation in how many songs an individual species has within the group of birds that learn song. And so some of them do have more than 1,000 different song types that they sing. So there's birds, also local birds. Brown thrashers have a lot of songs. Gray catbirds you can also find locally around Springfield, around Missouri. They sing a huge number of different songs. And one thing that those species have in common is that they incorporate other sounds. They can hear other sounds from their environments that aren't just their own species. And they'll hear those, and they do this thing that we call mimicry, where they'll mimic sounds from their environment. And that's partly how they put together those kind of gigantic repertoires of songs. And then there are a lot of other species that sing far fewer songs. And even among the birds that learn song, some species just sing one song. So they'll sing one song type, and they do it monotonously, just over and over and over again. Just like you're saying, you could get very bored of listening to it very quickly. And that's the entirety of their song repertoire. They just hit that one, and the value of that song or how that individual is judged by its competitors and by potential mates probably has to do with how well it repeats its song and doesn't vary. So this plays out in different ways among different species, for sure.
Well, like I said to you privately, I grew up in Arizona, and I used to hear meadowlarks. And there was a particular meadowlark variation in northern Arizona that had a particular song. And as far as I could tell on my hikes, it sang pretty much the same exact trill, which was about 5.5 seconds long constantly. Is that something that it's doing? What is it doing? Identifying where it is or who it is or what it owns or what kinds of things is it doing with that?
Yeah, most likely what it owns. So so meadowlarks are defending territories that they'll use. A male meadowlark will sing. Females, there might be some song in female meadowlarks. I'm not sure. That's actually a kind of burgeoning area of research to try to recognize that female birds, in addition to male birds, sing. But predominantly, in most songbirds, the males are going to sing more, at least. If not exclusively, they'll sing more. So those meadowlarks that you're hearing, did you say in Flagstaff?
Yeah, this was in Flagstaff.
Yeah, they're probably defending a territory, and they might also be seeking a mate. Birds have a kind of system. A lot of the songbirds have a system where the male defends a territory, has a social mate who's a female. Some species, they might have multiple female social mates with whom they'll, maybe build a nest, sometimes not help building the nest and just the female build the nest. Sometimes the male helps building the nest. And they'll raise young, and the males in some species will assist with the raising of the young. But then there's also singing might be involved in trying to find other mates outside of the social mate. So birds will mate outside of their social pairing. And so that's probably also playing a role in why those meadowlarks are singing. They're defending a territory, looking for a social mate, and probably looking for other birds to mate with beyond their social mate.
Now, there could be a whole bunch of different avenues you could explore, obviously. I mean, just the things we've talked about. So talk about a specific project you're working on right now that might have some tie into Missouri.
Okay, so one thing that we're currently working on is studying this species called Buick's wren. And Buick's wren is kind of a crazy backstory. It used to be really, really common in Missouri. It used to be really common further east and north of here, up to Wisconsin, Minnesota, all the way out to upstate New York, close to the East Coast and Maryland. It used to be just a common bird that hung out around farms and around residential neighborhoods and all that area. It's retracted a whole lot. So now the kind of northeast edge of its range seems to be within Missouri, and so it's disappeared from a huge fraction of its range. And now in Missouri, it occurs at really low densities. It's really sparse. They're hard to find, these birds. Birders are really excited to find one, generally speaking. And so in these circumstances where the birds are really sparse across space, one of the things that's intriguing from a song learning standpoint is if you think about an individual male Buick's wren being born in an environment where it has very few individuals around to learn from, then it might limit how many songs it will eventually sing. So how much variety it will be able to incorporate into its repertoire of different songs. So we think that low density circumstance might turn out to limit how many songs a bird can sing. And we think that kind of corresponds to limiting a cultural complexity within the species.
So how would you go about, what does your group do now to study this particular kind of a thing? So lead us through how you get your data and what you're going to do with it.
So you can imagine that we need to go out into the field to do this. So so we find Buick's wren individuals who are territorial and singing a lot and holding a territory. And we use some kind of fancy microphones and go out and make sound recordings, and we try to capture the entirety of the song repertoire from individual singing territorial males. And then we make these long recordings, and then in order to analyze them, we put them into a computer, we visualize them and make something that's called a spectrogram. It has some other names too, spectrograph, sonogram. To visualize the song and then be able to make measurements on them. So the visualization of our recordings, the visualization of the songs, allows you to look at what's happening with pitch as it varies over time. And so when you visualize it like that, you can make measurements, you can identify pieces like notes of the song and take measurements on what frequencies are occurring at what point in the song, at what point within kind of each note, how those frequencies change across the song. And so what we're doing for the Buick friend, because we want to understand how many song types each individual has, is we're going to take those measurements, and then we're going to try to, using a set of statistical procedures, characterize how many songs are found in each of the individuals for which we have recordings.
So when you say statistical, so most people would think I can tell the difference between one song and another, but you have to have some sort of verifiable, or let's call a predetermined way to say this is a difference. And so do you work on that? Who establishes how much difference really means that it's a different song, or how is that done? Is that different groups or?
Right. So this is, it's a tricky thing to try to get at. And so on the initial recordings that we have, so I'm working with this grad student, Zach Vickers, and he has listened to these recordings. And I didn't know for these Buick friends how distinct these song types were going to be. So they sing different song types that have been previously described in the literature and described as these kind of discreetly different variations of song. And having worked on some other birds before, I was curious about how different the songs would be. And so in working with Zach, one of our first conversations about what was on these recordings, he just kind of said to me, oh, this bird had 7 song types. And I kind of went, what? Like, how did you know they were different? He said, oh, I just like listened and looked at the sonograms and they were really evident. So to some degree, they seem to be possible to subjectively score, right. And that's been done a whole bunch. But we are seeking more quantitative methods to do this. We want to nail this with a more quantitative approach. And so what we're doing is trying to measure all of the kind of individual notes that make up each song and then characterize them using a set of measurements, compare them amongst each other, and use some methods called clustering methods to try to sort out how many kind of different kinds of notes we have in the songs. And then eventually the idea is that we're going to do sequence analysis on the notes that are sung within songs, which would be pretty similar to the kind of sequence analysis that people use to try to understand how DNA has evolved. So moving from one note to the next, like we would move from one nucleotide to the next in a DNA sequence. So that's what that's the goal. That's what we're trying to get at. And it's kind of a new approach that we're
excited about. Well,
that's very interesting.
Are you using for your clustering? What are you using? Are you using something like principal component analysis or something like that?
It would be something similar, probably.
Because I happen to be doing some work on that with infrared spectra right now. We should talk.
We should talk. Yeah.
yes, very, very interesting. So now you have all this data that you've got, and how are you trying to correlate it? Because the idea is that sparsity of paucity of tutors decreases song. So are you trying to correlate it with density measurements and things like that, or what are you trying to figure out?
That's exactly right. So we're in a really fortunate position in studying birds that there's a lot of information out there about where individuals of any species can be found. In North America, this is the case. So there is a long record of people having gone out every year and in a systematic way surveying birds. And so there's a long-standing record called the Breeding Bird Survey, the North America Breeding Bird Survey. And so we are trying to use our recordings, which are going to be from Missouri and Oklahoma and Texas and perhaps some other locations in the U.S., and also some historical recordings that were made to make these comparisons where we can look in places where the density is really high, look in places where the density is really low. And we have at least pretty good information on where the density is high and where it's low from this long-standing record of surveys. And not only that, because these surveys have been done over a long period of time, about 60 years, we can go back and for these historical recordings, we can figure out what the densities were in different years. And so that's our plan, is to be able to get a good estimate of the density for all of these places from which we have recordings, our own recordings, and historical recordings based on this record of other people doing a good job figuring out what the densities are for many species.
Fair enough. So this is field work tied into lab analysis of field work and then correlated with other field work. How about mathematical modeling period, where people are basically saying, we're going to now take some sort of mathematical model and actually have it systematically try to, something like a genetic algorithm, evolve the song. Do you guys have any, do anything like that?
Like evolving the song from just no starting point?
You know, People do these studies where they're basically doing modeling techniques and they try to look at evolution of this or that or the other thing just due to pressures. I don't know exactly what pressures you'd put on it to make it happen.
Right.
But I wonder if anybody's doing mathematical modeling where they're trying to, without lab data necessarily, mm-hmm. or maybe only on the front end, try to make things then evolve down the road.
Yeah, it's something I'd like to get into some more with Song in particular. And there are some people out there who have tried, so we have this peculiar case, a little bit peculiar in that the learning process allows these kind of memes to be transmitted among individuals.
Right.
And so there are some, there's some new modeling work on cultural evolution that I'd like to pick up on and extend on in the future, if I can get to it.
No, that sounds really, really good. Amazingly enough, we've gone through quite a bit and probably enough for people to try to digest. Jay, thanks so much for stopping by and talking to me about this today.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure.
Once again, this is Dave Cornelison for the webcast version of STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.